This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 1 in 68 children in the United States will develop autism spectrum disorder. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. And while the field of autism research has grown rapidly in the past few decades, there is still much to be discovered. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is at the forefront of much of this discovery. Researchers there have made breakthroughs ranging from findings that identify genes linked to autism to a new study that shows that it's possible to use MRI scans to predict whether or not certain babies with autistic siblings might go on to develop autism themselves. Dr. Joseph Piven is a psychiatrist at UNC who's behind a lot of this research, and he directs the Carolina Institute for Developmental Disabilities. It's a program for services, research, and training, all relevant to individuals with developmental disabilities and their families. And he joins me in the studio today. Dr. Piven, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's take a deep step back and tell us what we know about autism. Describe the spectrum for us and what it is we're talking about.
Right. Well, autism is defined by a set of behavioral features. There are two cardinal domains, a particular type of social deficits, and then a sort of another domain that comes under the umbrella term of ritualistic, repetitive, and stereotype behaviors. The other, I think, defining feature is its course. It's apparent in very early ages and continues in some form or another throughout the lifespan. We now very clearly know that it's a highly genetic disorder, not in all cases, and we know that it's based on certain kinds of abnormalities in the brain. And the other thing that we know is that while we call it autism, it's not one thing. So that all the kids and folks that end up with a diagnosis of autism get there through various different pathways.
And you said that you're able, that it begins at an early age and generally stays with the individual throughout their life, but only at the age when behavior begins to be detectable. So maybe as a toddler, but generally speaking, not before, up until now, right?
Right. Well, this is actually new and very exciting information. It's a new way of thinking about autism. In the past, I think we all thought that it started from sort of the get-go, and we just couldn't really discern the features until kids got a little bit older. But we have this new way of studying autism, and that is studying infant siblings of older autistic individuals who are themselves at higher risk for autism, so about a 1 in 5 risk. So it's a much more efficient strategy. And we can then study these infants before they look like they have autism, and from 3 and 6 months onward. And the big exciting finding in the field, you know, 6-month-olds are actually very social beings. And what we see at 6 months of age in the kids that go on to develop autism is that they really are indistinguishable from those that don't. So they have a period of time in the first year where we think of it as sort of pre-symptomatic, where they don't look like they have autism. And then in the second and third year of life, the defining features of autism really unfold. And then diagnosis is typically sort of earliest at 24 months, but more so in the community later at 36 months and 4 years.
So what is it? Can you tell us what it is then you're looking for with MRIs and what that's telling you that the behavior of a 6-month-old might not?
Right. Well, once we realized that that was what was going on in autism, we crafted a very large neuroimaging study. And what we found is that the brain has very dynamic characteristic changes during this period. And if you looked at a child at 6 months of age, they would have different brain features than a child at 12 months and 24 months. So there's no real sort of neural signature, if you will, of autism. But what we also did was start to look in this first year of life to see if we could find brain markers that might predict which of these high familial risk children would develop autism. And we've been successful with that on several fronts. And one paper was published a few weeks ago in Nature suggesting that we could correctly identify by 12 months of age 8 out of 10 kids that would receive a diagnosis at 24 months of age.
And what's the advantage of this then, knowing at a much earlier age, say at 6 months, that there's a greater likelihood?
Right. Well, I think in general in the field, although we don't have great data on this, we think that treatment earlier is better. And this would be before the appearance of autism, so before the appearance of the characteristic brain features, and at a time when the brain was most malleable. So there's, I think, wide-held beliefs that we would have more success at that time. And in a way, it's much like what we see going on with degenerative brain diseases at the other end of life, where when you, if you walk into your doctor's office and you have symptoms of Parkinson's disease, at that point you have dramatic changes that have already happened in the brain. And so we're a little bit sort of behind the eight ball on that. And this is really the same story. We want to try and think about intervention and detection before the onset.
But since we haven't known that children that early, we haven't been able to detect autism in children that early, are there treatment regimes that are designed for infants at that stage? Since, again, they're, as you say, they're radically changing in terms of brain development, and I would think behavioral development. So does this, is there, would there be a separate treatment regime for children that young, or is it pretty much the same thing, just start earlier?
Well, it would be sort of a downward extension of some of the same things. At least that's our concept now. It would have to be developmentally appropriate. But in truth, we really don't know because this is such an uncharted territory.
What about what do we know genetically about the genes that are linked to autism?
Right. Well, that's been an area of dramatic change over the last 5 years, really because of the tremendous technologies that we have now for looking at genes. And I think some of the key findings are that in about 20% of people with autism, we can find an identifiable genetic abnormality that seems to explain the autism risk. These are rare occurring events, maybe one in 1,000. But oftentimes, if you have that genetic abnormality, it's highly likely that you will get autism. In the rest, I think there's just sort of increasing complexity about the genetic mechanisms that are operating, from multiple small genetic effects sort of coming together like we see in something like height or blood pressure, to the effects of environmental kind of influences as well. But we are, I think, making really great strides in trying to define the genetic architecture.
And, of course, the complexity is also inherent in trying to figure out whether or not it's not an either-or situation in terms of whether there are environmental causes or genetic causes, but the way in which a genetic abnormality might leave one more vulnerable to an environmental effect that others might not have the same effect.
Right. Well, even in the cases where we find a single gene abnormality, that gives us insight into other kinds of brain changes in autism. It just makes the problem much more easily studied.
And one way I think that you've made some advance in this area is that I understand there's a potential link between fungicides and autism where a genetic abnormality has been identified.
Right. Well, one of the sort of remarkable things about our large group of autism researchers at UNC is the breadth of research. So we have folks that are studying, as I just mentioned, brain-behavior relationships and looking to find genes. We have a group of really world-class basic scientists studying the sort of basic mechanisms and causes of autism. And there are several that have had a series of very high-profile papers, starting with a paper that looked at a particular genetic model of a genetic subtype of autism in a mouse model. And they were able to take an FDA-approved compound and reverse that genetic effect in a mouse model. And they've moved forward with that research. That was research done by Ben Philpott and Brian Roth. And Mark Zilka most recently has looked at the genetic signatures, the expression of genes exposed to environmental chemicals and toxins. And what he discovered was that the pattern of expression of those genes when they're exposed to fungicides looks very much like the pattern of expression in autism. And so it really sort of marks them as a as a focus of future research on the causes of autism.
And I understand UNC is also part of an initiative to sequence the genomes of 50,000 people with autism and their families. Tell us about that and the significance of that study.
Right. Well, this is really a remarkable undertaking. It's funded by the Simons Foundation that fund a lot of autism research these days. And the idea is to identify 50,000 people with autism around the country, get saliva and DNA from them and their parents with the idea of really two things. One is to find genes. We now know that we need massive numbers of subjects to find genes of small effect. But maybe more relevant to us locally is that a number of centers have been engaged in this. We were one of the pilot sites with the idea that we might be able to find 3,000, 4,000 individuals with autism in our community and get this very detailed genomic information. And then we don't have the problem I was alluding to before of sort of apples and oranges, trying to study all kids with autism as if they had one thing. We may actually be able to identify the 25 that have a particular genetic mutation, understand how that affects the brain, and understand how we might help those folks with targeted kinds of treatments, both pharmacologic treatments and behavioral and educational treatments.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for taking the time to bring us up to date.
Thank you.
Dr. Joseph Piven is a psychiatrist and the director of the Carolina Institute for Developmental Disabilities. You can find out more about the Institute and the research at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a conversation with hip-hop artist Talib Kweli on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.